You're listening to Talk on East London Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to Talk. This is our third week. I'm Lauren. I'm hosting today. It's my first time hosting, so please be gentle. Please tweet us at Talk ELR Radio or just at ELR Radio. We would love to hear. Nadia is checking out our social media, so if you've got any strong opinions, do come in. Today we have all new guests. We have Amy.
Hi.
Faris.
Hey, morning.
And Shantu.
Good morning.
And I'm Lauren. We are going to be broadly speaking about health. We've got three health-related topics, and then Faris is going to remind us how to stay off our phones later this afternoon. Because the rest of us haven't, this is my second time and everyone else's first time, we'll do a quick introduction. So, Amy, tell us about yourself.
Hello. I am a student currently completing an undergraduate degree at King's College London in global health and social medicine.
Yes, we've got the expert in the building. Yeah. Why were you interested in radio? How did you come to be on the radio today?
Well, I want to be a science journalist when I'm older, so I think that radio is probably the way to go.
Yeah, amazing. Who's your like science journalist like hero?
I'd like to do something that isn't just journalism. It's a lot of broadcasting, science programs. So there's a few.
Brian Cox, watch out.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And Faris.
Yeah, so I'm actually 28 and I've been in London for, I think, about 8 years. Mm-hmm. First time here. I appreciate the opportunity, so I'm very excited about it. Well, I do work in accounting, so also trying to work on different projects. So radio is one of them, for example.
Cool. Yeah. Amazing. Hey, Shantu.
Hi, I'm Shantu. I live in East London. And also I have completed MA and MBA. But nowadays, completely different thing is a passion of mine. Mm-hmm. I love to work on the media, mm-hmm. especially in radio. That's why I'm here today.
Cool. Welcome, everyone. We will start the discussion today. Amy's going to kick us off with her intro about health and pharmacies and primary care, I guess, is the way to talk about it.
I'm going to be talking about the options available to a person when they are ill. Mm. As we know, in recent news, there's been a continuous focus on issues in healthcare in the UK, with people being encouraged to avoid their local accident emergency departments unless it's absolutely necessary and they know that they need the help that accident emergency can provide. This advice has been supported by many healthcare professionals within East London, but are these alternatives likely to catch on is the main focus of my topic today. I came across a news article in the Ilford Recorder, and
shout out to the Recorders in East London.
And there was a lady that has owned a pharmacy for the last 30 years on Ilford Lane, mm-hmm. and she says that they have had a program for people to come in, get a diagnosis with minor ailments such as coughs, colds, you know, for all the way from athlete's foot to diarrhea and scabies.
Wow.
So, but
good morning, everybody, with your breakfast.
Sorry about that, guys. But personally, I had never heard of such a program before, and it was very interesting to hear her point of view, saying that she was a qualified pharmacist, she had obtained a 5-year degree in order to be a pharmacist, and yet she was still receiving questions from people, you know, are you qualified to treat, for example, my children? And it's interesting because the Recorder also said that only 6% of people with under 5-year-old children will actually go to the pharmacy first, even though it takes a lot of strain off of the parent by making a GP appointment. The GPs are packed anyway, without going to A&E. And I just thought it was really interesting that I hadn't heard of it. And I'm somebody who is completing a degree in the health sector. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if anybody else had heard of these kind of programs before.
One of the things that interests me about this topic is actually something I went to recently, a talk about health and like the mind and the mental state related to health. And that person talked about the placebo effect, or the effect of going to someone who you trust as receiving health. So I just wonder whether, you know, as a parent of a young child, whether you do believe that the pharmacist gives you drugs, but the doctor tells you how to be better. What do you guys think? Would you go to a pharmacist if you were, like, you know, not feeling great, or is the first person that you think to call, like, the doctor?
No, I feel it's about to go to pharmacist first, because it's saving the time for emergency department, saving the time for GP who are more ill than us.
Mm.
So I think it's better to go to for the minor things, like coughing or I can say a fever or any kind of minor sickness if you have got, but to go to pharmacy first, mm-hmm. just to save other people's life who are more ill.
So you would do that? You support this program?
Of course.
Yeah, right. And what about you, Farah?
I think sometimes we do get a little bit worried about health for a little bit of nothing. Because, if you have a cough, it's not like it's... Yeah, because when you have a cough, sometimes it's not really serious. So you can just have your own medicine going to, pharmacists. But also, I know there is like an app, I forgot what it's called. I think it's with GP or something. So you basically have a chat with your GP online on your smartphone. So I don't really know how it works, but that's another offer, I think, for people also to use instead of just going to the hospital.
Yeah. What do you think, Amy? What do you think about the program as someone who's doing like global health?
I think the program is fantastic. It reduces strain on GPs who need to have the time to see their patients personally. Therefore also reduces strain on A&Es, which are overbooked anyway in the UK. But I think that it needs a signal boost. As the lady who owns the pharmacy in Ilford Lane says, her name is Shaheen Bhatia.
Mm-hmm.
I apologise for any mispronunciations. She says that the clinical commissioning groups mm-hmm. are the ones that decide which programs to fund, and that her experiences, a lot of people don't know about it because of that, because they aren't necessarily funding it as much because they don't think it's as important.
So I'm not originally from the UK, and so I've had to understand how the whole health system works here, which is quite different to Australia.
Lots of red tape.
Lots of red tape. The thing, like, ordinary people know what a clinical commissioning group, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
People know what that is, right? I didn't know what that was. I was like, what does that even mean? And what does it have to do with the fact that I feel crap today? But actually it means that they're giving you the... They fund each of the trusts...
Yes.
Is that right? That then...
They're the ones that decide who gets the money and who doesn't.
And they decide within each local authority or within each trust?
I'm not entirely sure.
Cool.
But
if there are any clinical commissioning group people on the social media or listening
please
today, please get in touch and let us know.
I don't think they know where the money goes.
Oh, really?
In those situations, it's bureaucracy and tape.
There's a conspiracy here somewhere.
Yeah.
One of the things that that disturbs me about this, because I had heard of this kind of push for everybody to go to the pharmacies instead of their local GP. One of the things that bothers me, and then maybe this is because I'm old and a hypochondriac, is that I come from a culture where you go to the doctor not just when you're sick, but as like an ongoing relationship with someone who understands health in like the broader scheme of things. So even if you are going to the doctor for your cold or your athlete's foot or your scabies, that they, because they have all of your information and all of your understanding about your health, that they go, you were here 2 weeks ago with this, or I know that you're off sick with stress, and that they can connect it with the other problems that you have. I think I need to start wrapping this conversation up soon, but it leads perfectly into the next one about, does the pharmacy, if you go to the pharmacy for your health, does that lead in to, or is that supported with your health as a whole, rather than just kind of cherry picking the different problems, and that you just end up
the upstream causes of your for example.
Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Okay. The upstream folk.
The upstream causes is something that, for example, if you have a river,
yep,
and people are being poisoned by the water that they drink from the river, then you offer them a filter. But in reality, the upstream problem is that there's a factory dumping something in the river.
So yes.
You target the upstream cause first, then that's the thing that...
Yeah, and so straight. What I'm hearing, what I believe, and I don't know because I'm not doing global health, but I don't think that going to the pharmacy will solve the symptoms, but it doesn't necessarily help with some of the root causes of health and
well-being.
Well,
the social aspect of things. Getting exactly. to know your patient, yeah.
Exactly.
I don't feel like I have that relationship with my doctor at all, though, anymore.
I miss my doctor.
It's very impersonal really now.
Yeah. I'm scared to go. I feel like I'm wasting her time. She doesn't know me. She's not interested.
So we were talking initially about... We heard the buzzword upstream. It's not buzzword. It's probably a very useful term. Upstream. We were talking about pharmacy and health and programs run by the NHS to lead pressure away from GPs. And what we were talking about was how that didn't really give us an opportunity to have a relationship with our GPs and health as a whole. Shantu's topic is also about health as a whole and understanding the broader implications and the social implications of health.
Okay.
Take us away.
Yeah, hi. Today I'm going to talk about the importance and rejection of EHCP.
Tell us, what is EHCP?
Okay. It is an education, health and care plan for the children who are in special needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very important official document for the children in special needs to fulfill their needs, but it's coming back as a rejection from local authority.
Okay, so what we were talking about earlier was that that plan, who is the plan organized by?
It can be organized by from a doctor, from parents, it can be organized from by teachers, and whoever involved with that child or a young person. But it's coming back from local authority when they're applying for EHCP, coming back most of the times as a rejection. So what's the point of the EHCP if it doesn't help for the children?
And what does an EHCP rejection, what does an EHCP acceptance mean, and what does rejection mean for the child? So if they get this plan, what does that mean for the child?
Okay, so the parents applying for EHCP, because it's very important documents for the children, the importance parents applying for, because they can have a reasonable adjustment in the school and college.
Mm-hmm.
The children can have like a therapy, mm-hmm, like a speech therapy, occupational therapy. They can have many kind of facility at school if they have EHCP.
Mm. So extra support for their needs.
Extra support to fulfill their needs.
Mm.
And also they can have specialist school if they have EHCP statement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to have one. If they don't have one, there are many children currently getting a facility from school, like they're getting sometimes a speech therapy, getting occupational therapy,
mm-hmm,
but sometimes it gets stopped automatically when parents go to the teacher, why my children not getting any more? They say, we think this is okay, we can manage your child, she doesn't need any extra support.
Mm-hmm.
When she or he has got a EHCP statement, they cannot say no.
Okay.
They have to apply, they have to implement every single day for the children to be socialized, to improve their communication skill,
mm-hmm,
for eating, for writing, for reading, for everything.
So this EHCP and this EHC plan determines and I guess what's the word I'm looking for, like makes it mandatory that these children get this extra support. And so you were saying that lots of parents are getting, and children are getting, these rejections.
There are lots of rejection out there, and but the problem is people are, the parents are really sad nowadays. They're not applying for ESCP if the children has no problem.
Okay.
Children suffering from ADHD, from autism,
okay,
dyslexia.
And why aren't they applying?
They're applying to have a secure statement. It's a law.
Why are they not applying? You said they're not applying?
Some of them not applying because they don't know. They're thinking it's a very hassle. It's a long battle to go to make an EHSCP statement. It's normally 20 weeks process.
20 weeks.
But it's taking...
So that's almost like half a year before you find out.
It's taking more than 20 weeks. Some parents... applied. It took more than 2 years.
Okay.
I'm gonna say about one parents.
And do you? What I was gonna say is, okay, just ask these guys if you'd ever heard of it. And Amy, I know we were talking before the show that you'd done some research on this. And do you want to add?
Yes.
Something.
The program itself, as Shantu explained, is very tailored to the child, and it sounds fantastic on paper, but when it's implemented, if it's implemented correctly, there is a 20-week wait, first of all, to actually get it issued in the first place.
Okay, so just to put that into... That's almost a half a year.
Yeah. So that is time that the child is not receiving the educational benefits that they require from applying for this plan.
So, Shanti, what happens when... So, presumably, there's students in East London who are having this same problem. What happens when a student is having to wait for 6 months?
Okay.
What happens to the child? Do they still go to school? Do they stay out of school?
No. Like sometimes from when they are in primary school, they move to be in the, they need to be in the secondary school. In the meantime, it's such a long time waiting process. Sometimes they're out of the school.
Right, so there are children who are waiting for this statement that is,
yeah,
sounds like it's taking forever, and they're not going to school.
And the story I'm going to say is a mum, the child suffering from, it's from the report from The Guardian, published last year. The child suffering from ADHD, suffering from autism, has one side got paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
So this child has having lots of problems throughout the life.
Mm-hmm.
My mum requested to the school, could you apply for my child for EHSC assessment?
Mm-hmm.
The school promised they're going to apply for the child EHSC assessment.
Mm-hmm.
But the school came back later after 3 years. She has been trying, but they're not listening hard. Then say, we couldn't help you, you need to do it by yourself. Then the parent, the mum, applied by herself. And then what happened, after 3 years, and then local authority has got her letter, but she has been rejected.
So after 3 years of trying to get extra support for her ADHD and autism
and paralyzed,
physically disabled son, they got a rejection, which means that child is not getting the support that they need with their health and with their education.
The mom has called to local authority, said, now what I'm going to do, I'm going to go to the appeal.
To the what, sorry?
Appeal.
Oh, appeal. Yeah, right.
So appeal, and then local authority said, okay, yeah, we can manage a statement for him.
What does that mean in terms of the health of a child? Like in that instance, is this the same kind of problem our situation, and especially in East London, people with like really difficult problems are having to just manage their symptoms rather than, same thing, getting the long-term support that they need for their issues. How about you, Faris? Do you have any experience with this or?
No, I've never heard of it actually, but I'm not really surprised. Or the length of the process, because anything with like government is quite long, because you need to get some approvals from different people and authorities. But I was just wondering if there's any other way to get support, like maybe from private, but I'm guessing that's about money in here.
No, it's very expensive for each child. It yearly costs more than 50,000 money But if parents having a good job, still they cannot manage. They need help from the local authority. The problem is, I'm going to say another scenario.
We'll probably need to wrap it up because we need to break for an ad. But I think this will probably tie in interestingly to the next couple of topics. We'll break for an ad and we'll come back in a minute.
You're listening to Talk on East London Radio.
So we were talking to Shantu about really important discussion about children, their health and well-being, and the difficulty and like very long process that children go through and parents go through, importantly, to get an EHCP, which is an educational health care plan. And Shantu was giving us some examples of parents who are waiting, you know, 3 years to get some support for their children when it comes to education. You were going to give us another example, Shantu.
I'm going to give you another report. It's from Social Care Ombudsman.
Mm-hmm.
The EHC plan rose from, the complaint rose from 109 to 217 in 2008.
So it doubled in a year?
Almost. So it's even the Social Care Ombudsman said, we are really unhappy the way we are dealing with that.
Mm.
And they said local authority should do their job properly.
Okay. So.
But another thing, the Richard Ward, he is the chair of Central Government Association.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it's not our fault. The problem on central government, because we are not getting enough fund to make a HACCP statement. So my question is, please, local authority and central government, whoever listening that, today's story, please don't blame each other. Investigate and increase, expand your fund as much as they need, because end of the day, the children are damaged, the family is damaged, we are not damaged, so we need to help them. And also lastly, I'm gonna say to all parents who are struggling, who are going through the old battle, so please don't give up.
You were talking about a helpline.
Yes, of course, who are listening, don't give up. Stay firm, and because you are the mom and dad who can help the best, you know what your child can achieve. The children who are in special needs, they are really amazing. If we give them proper help and support, they can be very talented. So lastly, I want to say another thing. The special parents, they are very special. That's why they have a special child.
Mm-hmm. There you go. So that is a note for parents who are struggling, especially if they're struggling to get extra support for their child with special needs. Amy, we were talking just off mic about other areas that, you know, money can often be spent in other areas in schooling, apart from the EHCP, which kind of leads me into the topic that I was going to talk about, which may kind of clash with Shantu's about the importance of spending on areas, wider areas. Well, I don't know whether they are unnecessary, but I'm going to talk about sport and sports funding. So you were mentioning that a lot of money gets spent on sport instead of perhaps with EHCP or other areas that work for special needs children, maybe like the arts and theatre and,
yes,
you know, speech therapy, some of those things. Money gets spent on sports instead. And one of the topics that I wanted to I'll talk about it briefly today, was related to sports. As some of you may have seen, I don't know whether you've seen the Nike London ads. Has everyone seen it? Loved it.
First time I saw it, I was like, oh my God, this is such a good ad.
Yeah, amazing. Have you seen it, Shantu?
Punches you.
Have you seen the ad, Shantu?
No, I haven't seen it, to be
honest. Yeah, wow, you're going to have to see it. What did you think, Faris and Mike? What did you guys think?
No, it's very representative to, of East London, so people from all different age, and it's real.
Yeah, as a real ad, really represented.
Describe it, mate. I've not actually seen it, so.
Okay, I don't know how to describe it fully, but it's an ad by Nike, who I don't normally, you know, usually that word doesn't come out of my mouth easily, but I will have to like give them regards. They had an ad specifically focused on London and what it's like, and what Londoners have to overcome, the barriers that they have to overcome to be a sports person in London, which I think all of the topics that we've been talking about today are really about what barriers people have to overcome to be in London, to be like healthy in London, to be, you know, educated in London, to be active in London. Some of the things that they were talking about, I mean, it was very humorous, but they were talking about the weather in London, obviously, but they were also talking about having to fight for facilities, the multi-purpose. Yeah. There's a scene in it where this guy is trying to play basketball in London on a multi-purpose, so having to fight like tennis players, a Jenga player, a football player, people sitting around. And it was really representative of London in terms of ethnic and cultural diversity.
Definitely.
You know, it had quite a youth feel, but it wasn't just that feel. One of the discussions that was there about, I had to ask myself whether it represented East London, and I certainly noticed that the discussions about whether Asian representation in that ad, I thought, were valid. And one of the things that I wanted to see for an East London focus, like if each of the areas of London had their own Nike ad, one of the things that I wanted to see was like the cricketers, who I notice in East London have to like get to the local parks at like 7 a.m. in the middle of summer to like cut out a pitch. But that also then led me to doing some research about health in East London and whether we are active and whether that ad did represent us. And one of the things I discovered was how actually we're not particularly active in East London.
No.
We're like, in terms of some of the statistics that came out from Sport London, like Barking and Dagenham, sorry to hate on you guys, but like two-thirds of you guys don't do any activity at all.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a lot of people. That's 200,000 people in Barking and Dagenham. Newham was second only by like 5% or something. I'm from Newham, but we're like 60% of us do not move. We don't do any exercise. Out of all of the boroughs in East London, Hackney was the most active, but even still, only 50% of people are moving on a, you know, on a regular basis.
What counts as activity, though?
So, good question. 30 minutes of moderate activity.
Yeah, no, I don't do any of that.
Sitting on a Saturday afternoon in a dark room at the back of East London somewhere. We are the problem. So that's the kind of activity. And one of the things I was thinking about was what that implication has on the wider social spectrum. So Sport England have been doing some campaigns to increase those numbers, looking at the gender divide, especially in East London, between men and women being able to be active. So some of the statistics that I was looking at were looking at who moves at all, and some of those shocking things that I was talking about aren't moving at all. And only like 6% of people are doing something moderately active every day, so some kind of exercise every day, which is a super low number. Which is, you know, the fact that Nike ad is able to represent sports people and we in East London felt represented, I think is quite amazing, because there's not that many people at that level. But Shantu, you were saying before that there's like 15 women who were...
Yeah, because as I'm going to say, because in East London, there's a lot of barrier in the women, because cultural fact, religious fact, they don't want to be involved in the sport. But that's why the Asian women's sports participation in East London, given coaching boost, this is the news from a London sport organization.
Mm-hmm.
They said 15 Asian women in East London were last month awarded AFL level 1 coaching qualifications to help low levels of sporting participation among female minority ethnic groups in London borough of Redbridge.
Yeah, great. So 15 women are like FA approved to be coaching.
Because their duty is now to encourage the other women who doesn't want to go to the gym, doesn't want to go to be in the field.
Yeah.
So they are encouraging women to be a part of sport, making them active, making them amenable to be a part of sport. So this is our duty and responsibility now.
So do you think, in terms of encouragement, do you think something like the Nike ad encourages people to have sport, or do you think that that is representative of the people who do sport and there are other ways to encourage us? So how do you guys get encouraged? What is your, like, oh no, I need to go to the gym encouragement? Is it an ad like the Nike ad, or is it stuff like Shantu was talking about, these like 15 women who are, you know, people you know and people who, you know, can now coach you in like football, or you find out about these information?
I think that the ad makes me proud to be from London, but it doesn't necessarily motivate me to go and, oh yeah, I'm going to go and play some basketball, play some tennis or anything like that.
Cheerleading, you didn't want to get flipped up in the air like that woman?
Not quite. Okay. But I think that there are ways to encourage people. I think it needs to be more of a group thing rather than like targeting people at home, sitting on their sofa. It needs to be go out and just, you know, kick a ball around with a few of your friends. It doesn't matter how you are active, just as long as you are active.
Yeah. Exactly. What about you, Faris? What motivates you to, like, move?
I think that's with your friends, because if your friends are really active around you, you want to be active. You don't want to be the one sitting at home, not doing anything. And I think also for people to get involved, they really need to not think of sports as a pain, but, like, enjoyment. So, because if you play football and you don't really like it, so you won't play next week or the following weeks. But if you're doing something you really enjoy, you don't even feel that you spend, I don't know, 2 hours practicing it, or, you know.
So what happens if enjoyment for you as a person isn't sports? It is being with your family, it's staying home, it's cooking, it's going to mosque, it's staying quiet, reading books. Like, what if enjoyment for you is solitary? Does that mean that you shouldn't be kind of prompted to stay active? Because activity is important for health too, not just like enjoyment or well-being. You know, some of the sports...
It's very important for health and fitness, because if you don't walk, if you don't do exercise, then what's going to happen at the day? You're going to suffer with the lots of things, lots of the back pain, foot pain, lots of things. So you need to go to the sport, or in the gym, or in the swimming. They're all of things part of sport. So we need to be very active to be healthy life, to be healthy.
To have a nice life.
Well, actually, the World Health Organization says that physical activity is characterized with medium and high intensity. High intensity is stuff like going to the gym, actively doing sport. But actually, medium intensity is stuff like walking or gardening or something where...
Neither of those things you can do in London very easily.
Cycling. We've got the new the Santander bikes.
Yeah.
It's something that... It doesn't have to be a chore. It's something that you just incorporate into your everyday life.
Speaking of the Santander bikes, have any of you guys tried... There's those new... So Santander are only... Like, if you live in East London, anywhere past Stratford, you can't jump on a cycle easily. Have any of you tried the new... Those new bikes that...
Yellow ones you're talking about.
Yeah, the yellow. And there's another colour that I saw that are a bit more like foldy bikes, and you just, like, log in and dial a number. Like, tell me, like, what do you know?
I don't know. I just seen them, but... No, I don't really know.
You don't know anything about them?
What, you're dialing
the bike? Yeah, they're not like locked into a dock like the Santander ones are. They're just sitting on the street and
it's
lock
a bit messy
somehow. And then I think you download something. I should probably have done some research before I said this, but it was something that I'm leading on from what you were saying, that there's other ways of getting cycles now, or, you know, having a bit more activity.
150 minutes a week, that's about 20 minutes a day.
Did you also know that the most popular sport in East London as a whole is badminton?
Really?
Oh, we're a bunch of badmen.
Yeah. I didn't know.
Badminton.
You're listening to Talk on East London Radio.
Don't forget to tweet us at TalkELR or at East London Radio. We were talking briefly before the break about those cycles that I didn't research, but that you, these magical cycles that you dial in, and we're talking about phones. Faris is going to give us a topic about smartphones today. What have you got for us today?
I just wanted to play a little game, but you already said what it was, because I was going to play saying, if I'm saying S8, Xperia, Nexus, you're going to all say smartphone, right? Because that's the little device that we all have nowadays. And the fact, if you look, the word smartphone is smart telephone, so we can do so many things with them. Because if you remember back in the day, we can just place a call and send messages like on a blue screen. It was so disgusting, you know. We didn't really spend much time with these phones, like these things. But now I'm just wondering if we need all these features, because obviously now we can pay. You don't even need your debit card or credit card to pay. We can take pictures, we can do so many things, but they're really, really expensive. And I've checked the latest numbers. So, for example, I think the last, on average for the new iPhone, people are paying about $800, which is about £580. So with £580, you can do so many things. You can buy a TV, you can go on holidays, I think you can go to Portugal, things like that. But we making sure that we have all the latest phones, so we're really keen to spend the money for that. But I'm still wondering, do we really need that? What do you think, guys?
Do we need our smartphones? Well, we need them to get these new bikes that I was talking about, that's for sure.
I think it depends on what you use them for. As a university student that takes an hour for me to get to university, I do a lot of reading on the train, and I do that with my smartphone. And I keep in contact with my fellow students with my smartphone. I have my timetable on my smartphone. So without it, I would have a lot more difficulty taking all the library books out and trying to read them all. But I think what you use it for is very specific. I'm not a big fan of social media, but other people may have a whole career based around social media. It's all the extras that you don't use that can distract you, I think. That's the problem.
It's interesting that you talk about how much we spend on our smartphones. I broke my smartphone a little while ago, in fact twice, and after the rigmarole of having insurance, etc., I was like, I'm not buying another fancy smartphone. So I went down to, you know, Stratford's and went into one of the small phone shops, of which there are many, and spent £40 on a smartphone. And it's actually, like, it's really lame. It's not going to be able to video, hey, to our YouTube peoples. If I tried to do that, would be really bad. So I miss out on the camera aspect. And there are some things, back to our discussion. So I can't download a lot of the apps that people use now. So I can't get, you know, I can't book into my gym, and I can't get one of the fancy bikes, and I can't download the, you know, the doctor's app that you were talking about, the GP app. And, you know, there's probably apps that are going to support, you know, children these days with their special needs. So I can't do that. But I still find it really valuable to have even just a very, very basic smartphone. But
it must be a very liberating feeling to be able to go back to sort of a 3310 time.
Yeah, yeah. And for those of you who are under 35, a 3310 3310 is like a really small phone by Nokia, which just has actual buttons instead of a screen.
But there's a new one.
Actual buttons.
Yeah. There's a new one, yeah.
There's a new one?
Yeah, it's got camera. It's very simple. I think it costs about £40-50.
I'd rock that. I would totally rock that with a flashing aerial, and I'd pay lots of money for some pixel art. But like, I've got an iPhone and it barely even takes pictures. So it's only got about 6 gigabyte of memory. Once I put Uber on there and like all my emails, I've got no space.
All your eBays? Was that like a Freudian slip?
But that's another thing as well, because all the brands, like, they have a new phones on the following year. So say you buy it today, and next year your phone will be outdated. So you need to have the latest phone. But what's the real difference between the old phone and the current phone? So it's just maybe a better screen, but do you really see the difference? But you love bragging about it and say, oh, look, I've got that new phone. My screen is much better. But do you really need that? I'm not really sure. So it's like, I also broke my phone. Didn't really break it, but I don't know what happened. So I've been told there is liquid damage in it, but
yeah,
I don't remember.
You dropped it in the toilet like I did.
Yeah, and I pay £130 for like fixing it, which is really expensive if you see it.
And so, what would you spend that money on if you didn't? So, say you got like a £40 burner phone, like we are suggesting. Mm. Like you're going to make us do. What do you suggest that we spend the difference between the £40 and the £500?
You get a laptop with the difference. You get like loads of stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
A new pair of Nikes, like following the ad.
For example. Well, Nikes are very expensive also.
Yeah, it's true. We're going to wrap up today's talk. But speaking of telephones, Shantu, you just wanted to let people know that there's a couple of lines that parents who were interested in the EHCP that advice. You were talking about. Yeah. So there's an advice line. Do you want to tell us about that?
I'd like to say advice line. Some parents are struggling to know how to apply for it. So there is an advice line called IPSEA, number 0800-018-4016. Also, another one called an independent supporter, Bernardo's, is 080-8800, again 0037, in London and for East London.
We'll post those on the social media site as well, so Shantu will get you to tweet those out for social media.
Thank you, everyone.
Oh, great. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next week.